Tibial shaft fractures are among the more common orthopedic injuries we'll see, certainly in orthopedic trauma. They are often treated with operative intervention, certainly these days, although in the past, functional bracing was much more common. So I think you should be very well versed in the treatment of these. If you see patients with trauma and fractures, and certainly in your training, you may have gotten very comfortable with treating these, or maybe you're earlier in your training and you're still trying to pick up some tips and pearls. So I'll try to go over some of the tips and pearls that hopefully will help you and not get into too much of the really, really basic stuff, which you can find elsewhere. So the first thing I would say, first tip is, like, if you plan on rodding a tibia, make sure that the rod's actually going to be able to get in the tibia. What I mean by that is check your canal diameter, check the length of the bone, and make sure that you don't have an oddball patient who just you don't have inventory for, or a patient doesn't have some type of bowing deformity or something. The canal diameter thing is probably what comes up the most. Certainly doesn't come up often, but you don't want to be that surgeon who gets caught stuck at a hospital where you can't get your reamers down, you don't have another set of sharp reamers, you don't have, you know, T-handle reamers, etc. I mean, some of you may be working at level one trauma centers and academic centers where you have lots of stuff, you have lots of equipment and instruments, and you're able to get out of a jam even if you maybe didn't plan for it. But many of you may go out and practice in a community hospital where they don't have everything, okay? To treat somebody with a really narrow canal, to ream them, you might need T-handle reamers, okay? You might need a smaller guide rod and a smaller set of reamers, for instance, that everybody doesn't have necessarily. You might burn through some reamers and need another set, okay? If you don't plan for that, at many hospitals, you're not going to have it, okay? So I think those are some key points to keep in mind. Now, as far as reduction goes, I talked about proximal third fractures, which present a particular set of challenges with regard to reduction and fixation and blocking screws and adjunctive techniques and semi-extended positioning, etc. I talk about that in a separate podcast, so certainly refer to that, because there's certainly some pitfalls and problems, and certainly something that's deserving of its entire own discussion. With tibial fractures in the middle third, reduction often is not that difficult. Usually it's something that can be done with manipulation. It's very uncommon that you have to open it. That said, though, you should be versed in the use of percutaneous bone tenaculum. So it's the Weber clamp, or the large pointed reduction forceps, can be used, especially with some of these oblique or long oblique type or spiral type fractures where it just doesn't quite key in or reduce nicely, and you can get a clamp on there percutaneously and get a pretty nice reduction sometimes. So you should be aware of that. Of course, in fractures that are difficult to get out to length, you can use a distractor. It's pretty uncommon in the tibia to have to do that. And I think most surgeons aren't using fracture tables or anything to rod the tibia, although that has been an option in the past. Now, there are standard techniques to rod tibia, and by standard I mean like using the flexed knee, like over a triangle or something like that. That's perfectly good technique. It's an infrapatellar technique. You make an incision either splitting the tendon or a medial parapatellar, you just rod the tibia, manipulate it, and then there's, I think, something you're going to see much more often now, which is a suprapatellar nailing, which is really something that helps address proximal tibia fractures. But I think you're seeing more and more surgeons now using this for rodding all their tibia fractures. I think it's worth mentioning a few things about it. It's percutaneous to some degree. I mean, you make an incision in the quad tendon, you split it longitudinally, you have to use some specialized trocars that protect the patellofemoral joint. The advantages of this technique, in my opinion, are that You keep the leg in the semi-extended position. It's flat on the table. It's not moving all over the place. So reduction techniques, reduction methods, when needed, are more straightforward. You don't have the knee flexed at 45 or 60 degrees and having the C-arm come at all different angles. The leg is parallel to the floor. The knee is straight up and down. You don't have to, you know, have the C-arm, again, coming in at all these awkward angles. And if you get an x-ray tech who's not accustomed to doing it, they're going to drive you crazy during the case. Of course, if you have a skilled team and skilled x-ray tech and you do it all the time, then it's, you know, not so difficult. But the semi-extended technique and using those percutaneous instruments to keep the leg flat on the table absolutely has some advantages with regard to positioning, with regard to imaging, and in most cases, the portal will be right in the spot where you want it when you place the trocars in the patellofemoral joint. So I think it's something you should be aware of at the very least, because you're going to see more and more of it. Now, keep in mind, tibia fractures can be somewhat slow to heal. They often can lead to autodynamization. Those happen more often with the smaller nails. So if you have 4 millimeter screws, so some of the instrumentation systems have 5 millimeter screws, and then when you get down below 10 millimeters, they are 4 millimeter screws for like the 8 and 9 millimeter rods. Those ones tend to break more often. That is the screws. So that's what I mean by autodynamization. Over time, as the fracture is trying to heal, it suddenly compresses as the screws break. Not necessarily a bad thing, but just be aware of that. It happens more often with smaller diameter screws. Weight bearing is another question I get asked a lot. Weight bearing is something that, obviously, with your polytrauma patients, you want to facilitate as much as possible. Certainly any patient you'd like to, if it's safe. Like if you have an isolated tibia fracture without good bone contact, the patient has no other injuries, maybe it's a very proximal or distal fracture, I think absolutely you're going to be non-weight bearing, okay? Tibial rods in general, at least how most surgeons do it, and I think this is worth mentioning, is usually somewhat loose fitting. I mean, you often don't ream up to fill the canal and stuff the largest rod you can in the tibia, because you can ream out more bone than you like to be able to achieve that. So you often have a little bit of a loose fit, and especially if the fracture is really proximal or distal, you can sometimes lose your fixation with loosening of the locking screws or windshield wipering, so to speak. So I think in those cases, you should limit weight bearing. But I think on the other extreme, you have a patient with multiple trauma who has reasonable cortical contact and has other injuries. You can really set that patient back by not letting the weight bear on that leg. So in that case, I think, you know, you weight bear, you take a little bit of a risk of loss of fixation. But certainly if you have a fracture pattern that seems that it's low risk for loss of reduction and fixation, and clearly the patient has huge benefit, like they'll go from either being in a wheelchair to being up and around, then you let them weight bear on it. And I think that's a reasonable rule of thumb. And the last thing I want to mention is that you have to really be careful, and the same thing goes with femoral nailing, is that you really have to be careful that at the end of the case, that your rotation is good, that your length is good, okay? So you really have to obsess over these things. When you do a case, you have to check radiographically, you have to check clinically, you have to check at the end of the case before the patient comes off the table, because you may not have prepped the other leg in the field. Now, are the leg lengths equal? Is the rotation okay? So you really have to pay attention. And if you have a case where you're not entirely sure as you're finishing the case if the rotation's okay, maybe a really obese patient, somebody you just can't judge because maybe they're externally rotating so much, you have maybe had to bump them up so the pelvis is not level. In those cases, when you've done your best but you're not sure, you got to then keep the instrument sterile. You know, if you didn't drape out the other leg, when you wake up the patient, you know, you really want to get the pelvis level, check the limb lengths, compare the rotation. And if you keep your instrument sterile, you don't, you know, dirty the back table and everybody keeps their masks on and everything, it's far better to revise a distal locking screw in the room while the patient's still asleep and before you leave the OR, than to find out on the floor or find out later, or God forbid you find out when the patient comes back to the office that they're malrotated and now they want something done about it and want to know why you didn't address it earlier on. Okay, so, you know, again, got to be a little OCD about this in order to make sure you don't, again, you're not that surgeon who has that type of problem. Okay, thank you very much. I hope this is helpful for you.